Thank you for tuning in to WPVMLP Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. A chance of showers and thunderstorms today with a high near 74. For tonight, showers and thunderstorms, the low around 65. Another chance of showers and thunderstorms on Saturday. We'll see a high near 80 here in the city. A chance of showers and thunderstorms for Saturday night with a low around 63. A slight chance of showers on Sunday, maybe some thunderstorms, mostly sunny with a high near 84. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today, my guest is Celia Gregory. Celia's joining us because I met her a few weeks ago, and she was telling me all about a book she has just written titled Hippie Wars. Celia's from London, so she brings a different perspective to the term hippie. As it turns out, and you'll learn this in our interview, the hippie vibe in Europe was different than the hippie vibe in America. And in fact, hippie does not just define one category. Urban hippies in the big cities, rural hippies in the South, the Western hippies like in Taos, the ones who founded the communes. New Buffalo, for example, I think is still active here in Taos. In Asheville, there were the hippies who gathered there for the Back to the Land movement. I believe there was the farm in Tennessee, which is a bit west of Asheville, and in Black Mountain, up Highway 9 going over the mountain where all the devastation from Hurricane Helene happened, there's a place called Earth Haven. It's not a commune, but it's a gathering that can trace its roots back to those communal sensibilities and to the hippies. I was never a very good hippie. I failed a bit as a hippie because I tried to fit in, but I didn't fit in. I ironed too many shirts. And so because I love to iron my shirts and I tried to wear flannel, but I kind of leaned in the direction of cotton and linen myself. I didn't quite make it as a hippie. That said, the hippie movement and the counterculture movement had a big impact on America and beyond. So today, Celia will reflect a bit on that. She will tell us what she's learned in her research writing her book titled Hippie Wars. And I start by asking her about the book. So here we go. Hippie Wars got me thinking about the late 60s and the 70s when these scenes called communes and traveling around, hitchhiking, going overseas and exploring Afghanistan and all the mobility of that very young generation, all that was going on at the same time the Vietnam War was going on. And even though the hippie movement was all about peace and love, it actually was also all about war, because the generation was at war with the culture, driven by the war that was going on in Vietnam and all of the other things around the world, the tension. So yeah. Hippie wars, I want you to start by telling me what your reflections might be on that era in relationship to peace and love, and then the tension of war and conflict all playing out at the same time.
Like you said, when you first think of the word hippie, war is kind of potentially the opposite of it. But as you explain, it's, you know, didn't the peace and love thing come out of, you know, the young boys, particularly at that time, not wanting to go into the draft? So, you know, I think the slogan that becomes something that's archetypal for the hippie movement is because of the fact that these boys didn't want to go to Vietnam, didn't want to go to the draft. And so Make Love Not War is Woodstock, is let's dance and let's listen to music. You've got Jimi Hendrix, you know, at Woodstock playing the Star Spangled Bangle, whatever it's like. I play with words a bit by mistake. But, you know, the whole audience at that time, they say, went silent, because even after 3 days at Woodstock, the idea of playing around with the national anthem of America was already like, oh, is that kind of okay, you know? And so one of the feelings I have is that Woodstock and the hippie movement was protesting against war. I've done interviews myself with people like Cisco, who's a local in Taos. You know, his father worked at Los Alamos. I think he ends up being number two in the draft numbers. Part of him wants to go to war because he feels that's what it means to be a man. That's what he's being taught. But then he just happens to meet some people that are anti-going. He then reads various books and he concludes actually at the end of it that he really doesn't want to go and be maimed and, you know, have his life completely ruined, and that he really just wants to go to a commune and have sex. You know, so, I love, because I don't think anything's black and white, and I'm always so fascinated by the nuance and complexity of things. And I'm fascinated by that era as well, that a lot of the parents that they're rejecting against would have actually probably fought in the Second World War. And then actually in my book, I do deal with the parents quite a lot. And my characters, Tim and Daisy, come from the father's actually, you know, his father was actually left Europe because of what was happening in Europe. He finds himself in America as a very poor immigrant. And actually the father of my character takes advantage of the GI Bill and becomes wealthier because he fights. So these are some of the things that I'm just fascinated with. So, yeah, I mean, I think they're intricately linked. I think it was a generational thing of people that prior to that, you know, the hippie movement, the counterculture movement, because I do contextualize the hippie movement in the greater story of counterculture. You know, I think that was just a limb of a bigger story of people questioning the 50s and this very restrictive, quite elite, hierarchical system that was being taken for granted, that was being kind of implemented on another generation. Yet these kids were experiencing the trauma of generations of men that have gone to war, you know, and that's another thing that I play out in my book, is the consequence of generational trauma. And that I believe personally that the violence that we see in America, the gun crime, the fact that we watch all our TVs and it's, you know, people are more comfortable watching people kill each other than they are kissing. And you'll have a young kid, they'll go, ah, if they see somebody kiss, but yet will be completely comfortable with somebody killing somebody else. So these are some of the things that I feel quite passionately about. I see, you know, just that trauma being kind of outplayed. I see that trauma then being used as a justification to perpetrate more violence. And I feel like we're kind of caught in this loop. And I felt like the hippie movement was trying to explore an ideal that was trying to break that cycle. It was inherently flawed, like a lot of the good ideas are, but I still value the inquiry.
Well, the inquiry is certainly important from a historical perspective. And this idea of the trauma passed down generationally certainly has great merit in my mind. I think it goes further back than just the 1960s. This whole country was founded on the ideal of freedom. Indeed, it was also a strong arm proposition from the start. Let's take the land because we need this land in order to express our freedom, and we will do it at all cost. The gun, great American symbol, people love and they hate the gun, has been with us all down through the ages. I think people are less undone by violence. Thank you, Gunsmoke in the 1950s. Thank you, all the other Westerns in the 1950s that we grew up on. People were shot in the Westerns as a way of solving the problems. So we have that tradition as well. And then, of course, Vietnam came along, and as well as all these other wars. So Vietnam actually was seriously major war. But as my friend Ocean Vuong pointed out, it was not the Vietnam War Ocean's families from Vietnam. He said it was the American war in Vietnam. And I thought, what an insight. We brought our war to them. And prior to that, it was the French war in Vietnam. And we just took it over and continued on with it. So violence is certainly part of our tradition, as well as the other thing. And I love the idea of counterculture, contra, against, yes. Fight. Yes. Let's fight this out. And it spawned what we have today. So imagine a lot of the people that were in the quote unquote hippie days and the hippie movements, the hippie wars, are also now in their 70s, as I am, 80s, and their 60s, many of whom are deeply involved in the right wing movement. So they've moved over. And so they're still keeping that contra against sensibility. It's alive even all these years later. And it's a really interesting thing. Sometimes, and this is a critique I've had of the hippie movement, and I tried to be in it myself. And I was never as successful at it as I would have liked to have been, because I think I might have mentioned this to you. I love to press my shirts. And the hippie movement didn't like that. You needed a uniform. And if you didn't have the uniform, you didn't fit in. So, you know, Ralph Lauren came later. Nobody would be wearing a pressed Ralph Lauren white shirt to a communal dinner. What? And so in a way, the hippie community was as gated psychologically as all of the rest. It was a repurposing of Americana suburbia into a commune, with the same set of values, just being expressed it with different clothes and different ways of going about things. Now, I don't know, in your research, did you see that as well? That's just my take on it, because I came through it in a way.
I think, you know, I often just, you know, I think Animal Farm is always such a fantastic book. You know, George Orwell's Animal Farm, just in the sense of that human thing that, you know, we have an ideal and yet somehow we keep recreating the same set of constrictions. So I think there's definitely a facet of that. You know, that's a human thing. And just because they were hippies, they didn't avoid that same pattern. Maybe they were trying to explore it. And that's part of the lesson learned, isn't it? Is this kind of fact that human beings keep repeating. You have a new generation. But I just want to add, though, is I'm from London. And I think one of the things that I have discovered in my research is that a hippie in London did a very different route than a hippie in Taos. Or actually, I'm learning that the hippies in California, you know, they had a different set of ideals. They were exploring something a little bit different than the very strong back to the land movement that the communes were in Taos. And then not even all the communes in Taos were genuine back to the land communes. A lot of them were actually just an excuse to take a lot of drugs. You know, one of the things that's definitely very clear about the hippie movement is sexual freedom, because we are experiencing a first generation of women that have the pill. And so, you know, that is something very real that was being explored for the first time. And I've interviewed a lot of women from that time. Some of the women are like, yeah, they were being, you know, abused, that abuse was in there. But, you know, equally, I've spoken to a lot of women that, you know, it was the first time they got to enjoy sex in a way that, you know, hadn't been accessible. Of course, there's going to be counters to that, as there just is in the laws of nature. Everything has a consequence. But that exploration, that sexual freedom, that as a woman growing up I was born in 71, to be able to enter into my adult life and to be able to have access to exploring that joy and that pleasure, I experience as a great, great liberation. So invariably, I'm very pleased for the people that stepped into that performing.
So how do you think that liberation influenced the other generations? Was it positive influence, healthy view of something that's quite natural, being sexual? And how is it played out now over the years? And personally for you, now that you're older, how does it inform the way you operate?
I mean, I'm definitely entering into this. As I said, I'm born in London. I'm born in 71. So I'm a hippie child. You know, hippiedom in London is actually very cool. It's the Beatles, it's Jimi Hendrix, it's Bob Marley. I'm living in an area of London where there's music studios are. It's fashion, it's Mary Quant, it's traveling across Europe on a bus through Iran, through Burma, you know, it's coming across. I mean, people say to me about Iran that they were the friendliest people. They were so hospitable, you know, and then you arrive in India and then you start to. So in actually, from my background, it was less communes and more ashrams. But for me as a woman, I mean, I'm growing up in a Christian background, you know, I mean, in essence, as a girl growing up of a Christian background, not number one, I'm a spare part of a man. Number two, I have to get married. And number three, you know, I'm kind of beholden to the men around me. The thing is, I grew up with three sisters. It's just all girls. I mean, I lived this reality when I was younger. And then suddenly I kind of entered the big wide world. It's like, what? Girls don't rule. So it is just, for me, definitely part of my identity has been the fact that I believe that we should be treated equal. You know, the fundamentals of America. And when I say equality, I don't just mean equality as in whatever my skin color is or, you know, whatever my sexual preference is. I mean, equality is a male and female. And invariably having autonomy over my own body, having consent, I just think is a birthright, really, you know. And I think that the fact that we live in a culture, I was still at the end of a culture where there was an entitlement for men that I just don't know where they felt like they were just allowed to impose themselves on women or, you know, I mean, I had a scenario where I was sexually assaulted and I spoke to a mother, actually, a friend of mine's mother, who, and she said that when she was younger, if you weren't escorted, you were fair game. I mean, you know, so these are some of the things that I feel that was the first time that now as a woman, you know, you could have sex, you didn't have to get pregnant, which means you then didn't have to either have a backstreak and abortion, which is what my mother had and nearly died. And the doctor would have been prosecuted. You know, I can now have sex. It's I think we're living in an era now where we're living in our heads so much. And I feel like we were coming out of a generation that was kind of bypassing these very important mechanisms of the body that they message to us. On the most basic level, that's intuition. But on another level, it might be we're young and we're moving into sexual maturity and we want to explore this wonderful thing that can make us physically relaxed. It's incredibly healthy for our body. You know, I feel as a human being, that's the one thing that makes being human so unique, is that we're in our senses. You know, when we're on the other side in bliss, we don't have a body. So, you know, I just felt like sex was a really beautiful thing. I do think that sex within relationship is a magical thing. But I think the ideals that it can only happen within that is something that's imposed on us by religion.
You said you are a child of the hippies. What are some of the other things that you have picked up, learned, incorporated, revised, taken into your life? Because it's interesting, you wouldn't say if you're a child of the hippies, then you couldn't be part of the hippies in the sense of the first generation, exactly. Which was a cultural, it was not counterculture, now that I'm thinking about it, as much as a cultural laboratory of experimentation that sometimes bumped into the status quo. Some of the experiments worked out, others failed. You can go across the spectrum. And as you've pointed out, and you've given me some insight, when I think of the hippies, I think of the ones that I was theoretically one of them. A hippie hitchhikes across the country and goes to a big music festival and smokes pot and grows some herbs in the backyard and maybe some tomatoes. Okay. More back to the land. But you have now given me some insight around the many, 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 many categories. I'm wondering if even, you know, hippie might be too much of a catchphrase. There's something else going on there. What did you take away from all that? Why did you find this movement, which was indeed global, such a shiny object to explore?
I mean, I think the music and drugs were probably my entry into, you know, I'm coming out of a very traumatic teenage years in London. You know, I think the spirit of teenagehood is a kind of counter, you know, anyway, that's just the kind of spirit of adolescence. So, you know, I'm being born into a Thatcher England, and, you know, we've got the, you know, they're trying to kind of stop us from dancing in the streets. You know, there's kind of, this is happening and it's just part of it. And I just super got into Jimi Hendrix and the guitar, and I love the music. And then on a very personal level, I was struggling to get out of these things that were happening to me as a teenager. And I think for me, it actually ended up becoming quite a spiritual thing, actually, the hippie movement. I think the hippie movement in England, as I said, with the movement over to the ashrams in India, you know, I'm now learning yoga from Shivananda. My teacher, Fausta Maria, was an original hippie. So the hippies are actually my mentors. You know, I'm not necessarily finding that I'm getting what I need from my parents in terms of philosophical inquiry. So I then look to these hippies and I have a series of mentors that I get involved with. So I will move into my conservation work, which is also another element from hippiedom that I've taken on, because for me, hippiedom was love. And that didn't just mean love of animals. It meant love of the land, love of, you know, the environment, you know, playing with the butterflies. And so, I mean, I grew up like loving nature, being involved in that. And then one of my biggest mentors in Bali, which is where I met my husband and why I ended up in America when I was doing my conservation work for the ocean, she was a big Osho devotee. And so, you know, she, you know, and I just, her story was just so extraordinary for me, what she'd come from in a post-war Germany. Her father was an SAS officer. He had systematically abused all the children. When she was born, her mother died in childbirth. She was the final child. All her siblings put her in care to get her away from the father. She then, you know, manages to kind of get through. I think actually one of the siblings ends up taking her back in. And she, anyway, when she first sees the kind of orange people, you know, she becomes involved in Osho. And, you know, that's, I mean, Osho was very much about sexual liberation. So I don't know if that gives you a little taster of how I'm moving into it, why I'm moving into it, and the influences that aren't necessarily cultural in the moment, but I'm working with the mentors who I feel were transformed through the experience, and I am attracted by that transformation.
So Osho was the guru who had the commune in Antelope, Oregon. Is that correct?
He started in Pune. His original ashram was in Pune, India, which still exists to this day. And you know, he's really offering this really new psychotherapy techniques where, for example, someone like Rani, who's coming out of a post-Germany trauma on levels that, you know, are just inconceivable, she is able to go to the Osho ashram and they do these kind of, I don't know if you know anything about, but they have these kind of really strong, like, you know, semantic stuff where you dance, you know, stuff that now is becoming mainstream therapy techniques. So this is what I find interesting about the hippie movement. They were exploring and delving at organic farming, you know, all of these things they were reviving that then, you know, has become something else now that we almost take for granted in a little bit of a way.
Right. I was in Asheville during that time, and a lot of the people who had spent time at the Antelope area commune, which was way out in the middle of nowhere in Oregon. I never went there, but I did know quite a bit about it. But one fellow there, quite charismatic guy, I liked him quite a bit. His name was Ramadeva, and he was one of the security guys on the commune who worked with Sheila, who was the manager of the commune. Quite controversial, actually, as it moved along, really. And yeah. Sheila managed to, she's still around. There was a big documentary film done on her, a five-part series. I think it was on Netflix. I don't know what happened to him. I think he finally just died, but he had cars.
They believe the American government poisoned him. What the American government did to Osho at the end was horrific. Actually, they moved him systematically around prisons. They humiliated the man. They literally humiliated the man. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it wasn't a good ending for him, and it wasn't fair. So he was very badly treated by the American government. And I mean, and like all of these things, there'll be multiple versions of it. And so, you know, and definitely some people didn't have a very good experience in the ashrams, especially children. Definitely my conclusion at the end of it was really the kids should have been kept off these places. And actually, when I create my commune in my book, I have a commune in my book, I've called it Lunar Landing. I'm very specific about keeping children off it because I just didn't want to go down that territory, because I do feel that that's where they failed. Because what is good for an adult in terms of liberation proved to be very confusing, and I don't think super consensual for the kids. So yeah, right.
And there was also in Asheville at the same time, running parallel to that, the Guru Maharaji Ji, the little guru, and there was a big community of Asheville people who had what they called knowledge. You would go to Guru Maharaji Ji, and he would give you knowledge, and then you would meditate on it or whatever, and then the other group, a fairly large group, the orange people, they always wore red or orange. That's why they were called orange people, were part of the Antelope, Oregon. And they were going back and forth from Asheville to Antelope all the time. I was friends and still am with some of those people, even to this day, actually. So you were part of the spiritual aspect of that. Now, there's some research from the advertising media point of view about how marketing recalibrated its focus on this group of people. So when the communes started and the hippie movement started in the 60s, likely rising out of the beat poets and that crowd that were roaming around, and then Ken Kesey's bus that he drove around on for quite a bit. But there was this whole idea of the communes as the place where people would solve all of the problems America had if only they would gather together as one and share the land, share the energy, share the sex, share all of this. But as they moved through it, I think it probably did threaten. It threatened a lot of people, and there was a great deal of pushback. And so along comes what Altamont, when the Rolling Stones, the Hells Angels kill somebody at a Rolling Stone concert, vaguely remembering this thing. Kent State rolls around and the National Guard shoots people. And somewhere in the 70s, late 70s, or throughout the 70s, people started turning inward to find the God within rather than the communes that gathered around. So it sounds like you came into the scene during that turn, when people were moving in the direction of self. Thus, you have the New Age movement. You have all of the Omega Institute could trace its roots back to that. Esalen out in California could probably trace its roots back to that. And so people became more internal with their work rather than communal. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm like you. I never really ever got involved in any group I never became part of a commune. I had friends who were in communes, you know. I even tried to get in. I mean, I'm a big yogi. So yeah, I mean, what happened to me is I went to India when I was 21 on the hippie trail. So we're talking 1990, I go to India for the first time. And it's definitely I just caught it on the edge of that. And I'm very much doing it from the hippie perspective, you know, smoking marijuana, hanging out with the sadhus, you know. But I am starting to be like, wow, this is kind of quite an interesting religion, because for the first time now, I'm seeing a male and female god and goddess together. So I'm seeing, you know, Parvati, she's an unbelievably beautiful goddess, you know. So now I'm kind of moving into a language as an artist and as a creative. I'm now moving in to a language that starts to sit with me in a way that I, as a female, can start to have a dialogue with mystery. I think that's kind of what I'm born into, an environment where I'm being presented with a Christian narrative. I'm being presented with a kind of system that I certainly am seeing my parents on, haven't made them happy. I am dealing with the backlash of their unresolved trauma. It's having a devastating effect on my life. And I feel like I've now been left the job of trying to make my life mean something whilst being surrounded by all of this stuff. And I felt like these new ideas were starting to give me a terrain within which I could start to understand myself differently. And I come back from India that time. I come back to London. I'm a mosaic artist, and I am getting chronic sciatica at 21. I'm in so much pain, and I think I tried a flotation tank to see if that would help with it. And then I go to my little health food shop which is like this cute little health shop in Portobello Market in West London, where we've got a lot of hippie Indian shops because of our relationship as England to India. That's just kind of part of us. And I see this little sign in the window for a yoga class. And it's with Fausto Maria, who actually had been a photographer with Gucci. And then he's a proper hippie. He'd actually got involved in the Shivananda, which is, I think, one of the first kind of Indian teachers that starts really bringing yoga to the West. And I go to his class, and originally it was in an office, and then we'd just move all the desks to one side and we do yoga, and my sciatica goes away. I also, prior to this point, had been a really, really bad bulimic and had managed to get out of being a bulimic, but I felt like I was still really left with the legacy of not really knowing how to manage my mental health. You know, at the end of a 2-hour yoga class, I felt a peace that I'd never experienced before.
You mentioned dialogue with the mystery, I think you said, or conversation with the mystery.
Yeah.
Go a little bit further into what you mean when you say the mystery. What does it feel like, look like? What kind of sense do you have of it? Is that your way of describing the totality of the unknown? Where do you stand with that?
Definitely mystery sits with the word faith for me, in the sense that, you know, yeah, the world is hyper complex. I mean, I think the complexities of it are so giant that I don't think we're ever gonna get it, you know? And so I feel like the intellectual mind is always trying to kind of get it. And I feel like, again, what was happening with the hippie movement, with the psychedelics, with the exploration, was finding new ways to experience the mysterious world that can't really be contained or described by the intellect. I mean, we keep trying with our creativity, with our words, with our poems, and we do a wonderful job in that moment opening a doorway into it. But yes, essentially, it's first of all feeling comfortable with the fact that I'm never going to know everything. Secondly, being able to dance in that place and feel the joy and freedom. I mean, I ultimately think that's what freedom is. I think ultimately freedom is the ability to be able to, you know, fly and experience everything, really. I mean, you know, I think the hippie movement kind of, you know, slightly compartmentalized into it only being love and joy. And certainly through my inquiries in life, that's not really what it is, you know, because I've realized now that as an artist, tension and heat and fire and it's all part of the ability to create. So, you know, yeah.
You've used the word freedom quite a bit. And I lately have been thinking about what that word means when it becomes attached to creative, the creative freedom. And people will often say to me, oh, Nave, you're a poet. Or are you a poet? Are you a writer? Are you a fill in the blank? And I've become less and less inclined to claim any of those categories. Not that I don't participate in them.
Yes.
And I realized that everything that I have done throughout my adult life, for good or bad, I don't know if I recommend it for anybody else, but it's been in service of my creative freedom, not my freedom to make an art object, but my creative freedom to choose as much of each beat as I can in my life. Choose it on my own terms, not always successful. I'd like for you to reflect on how you play your creative freedom out. Do you feel like you have it? Is it something that comes and goes? Is it something you're still trying for? Is it conditional or is it permanent? Where do you stand with that?
I'm an artist. I've been an artist all my life. Various mediums like you, I move through the mediums. I feel like the creative force moves through me. I've been less inclined to want to sign my work over the years just because I never, sometimes just didn't feel like, you know, it's more for me, creativity has always been a like letting go of my intellectual mind and allowing it to move through me. I mean, I recently mentioned this with my book that, you know, the initial writing process was definitely an intuitive thing. After that, there was 2 years of sculpting and forming and editing and really hard graft. So for me, there is something that happens here where you have the moment of it moving through you, which creates something, but then that doesn't take away the fact that there's an enormous amount of hard graft to really refine it. One of the things I've really realized now for me is that my creative process is my spiritual learning. I've got to the point now where, I mean, I have incredibly, I mean, for me, they're not like massively ambitious for other people, but they're ambitious. Like the writing of Hippie Wars was an ambitious project for me. And it mirrored in some ways a project that I'd set up 15 years ago called the Marine Foundation, which is when I conceived this idea. And I have this kind of spark of inspiration. It's totally crystal clear. It's not like crystal clear in the sense I know exactly what it looks like, but I just know it's like a seed has been planted in me. And then the mission, the spiritual quest begins. And that spiritual quest involves the opening up process to allow the creativity to move through me. It involves the reckoning that I have with my own idea, because, you know, I not only am I confronted by the physical limitations, I am then going to be confronted by resistance, because that resistance is a massive element that's going to form and mature the idea. But the resistance will often come in ways that I wasn't necessarily expecting and certainly don't like, you know. So, and then I grow. I mean, I learn so much through my projects. And when I say I grow, I don't just grow intellectually, I grow in myself by having to humble myself. I mean, humility is definitely a huge part of it. The self-doubt, the letting go of judgment. I mean, yeah, I mean, I know that you know what I mean because I know Imaginative Storm. So I think we're talking a similar language. But yeah, these are some of the facets. I mean, and I have come to realize now that when some people might be meditating on a mountain, I am going, oh, I'm going to write a book called Hippie Wars, and it's going to be about water, and it's to do with my interest in water, and it's a sacred lake, and blah, 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 and then, you know, all the really bizarre things that kind of happen as it unfolds, you know.
Let's focus down a little bit on Hippie Wars. It's a novel. What is the story Can you tell us what the story is? What happens in this book, and why is it an important contribution to this conversation?
I mean, the story started because of Taos Pueblo Peak. I came to Taos. I stayed at Mabel Lujan Dodge's house. I've been coming to Taos quite a bit, but I hadn't necessarily seen the mountain so much. But when I'm staying in her little back house, I have this window, and all it looks at is the mountain, you know. That weekend, we end up buying land, and we actually end up buying land that looks over the mountain. And now I have a studio that looks over the mountain. So, and then I just started doing research into it. And one of my inquiries during my conservation work has been the question of value. And really, really, you know, over and over and over and over and over again, even though we know what we need to do, we choose money over a different type of value. And when I was doing my work in Bali and all over the world, I mean, I had to take time off eventually because it was actually incredibly depressing. And I was like, God, how do I help? Or how do we start to explore that value exists separately for money, that there is an inherent value system that isn't solely dictated by money. And yet I feel that we exist in a framework at the moment that doesn't do that. And so I became fascinated by the legal case for the return of Blue Lake, because I felt that it was the most spectacular example of value for land and water that was separate from its fiscal worth. And then I was obviously totally inspired by the fact that the Taos Pueblo and many people fought 64 years refusing money over and over again. And then they have to go to Washington. And it's the most incredible premise of, like, you know, these one group of people trying to explain to the other group of people that value is separate from money. So that's what fascinated me by the book. As I did more research, I then realized that there was all these communes in Taos, and then it started to kind of align itself with a personal journey. So I then, because of when I was doing my marine conservation work, because of the fact that I do feel an integral relationship to nature, and I do feel that what I get from nature, you know, provides me something so wonderful. And that's what's made me want to try and preserve it, try and find ways that we can navigate that. And so that's why I wrote it, because the premise behind the Marine Foundation was approaching things creatively. Like I don't want to shove it down people's faces anymore. I don't want to say, you've got to value, you know, it's like, how does that kind of happen in somebody in a way? And so by creating a series of characters, by creating a story, I'm hoping that people, you know, attached to these, all these wonderful characters on this commune, I'm able to create a really elaborate collection of characters. So now I'm dealing with, I mean, I have a character who's David, his father's actually one of the lawyers that's part of the case. You know, he's a New York Jew. I have Isaac, he's, you know, Carib, you know, a Black American who's actually just come back from Vietnam. And so what I'm actually doing in my book is I actually create a series of conversations where this group of people can have a series of conversations, all through their kind of fun, unique perspectives. But it just provided me with this kind of wonderful chance to have a kind of conversation that actually I find quite difficult to have in modern society, because we're so opinionated, aren't we, that it becomes quite difficult to explore these things in a way that's safe and connecting, rather than combative and full of blame. And so I have done a couple of readings now where at the end of it, I then open up the conversation, and what I've created is a sense of joy and connection. And then the conversations that people are having are just so wonderful. So that's what I feel like we need more of, more interest, more openness, and more joy to some extent. Not to say that the book doesn't, again, deal with not very nice things, because that's just a part of life, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. And for people who are listening to this show, which airs in Taos on KCEI, Cultural Energy Radio, also airs in Asheville, and then it's on all the platforms. People in Taos understand what you mean when you say the Blue Lake and the mountain. Just a quick review. The sacred Blue Lake, as I recall, is at the top of the Taos Mountain. Taos Mountain sits on 80,000 acres of land that belongs to the Taos Pueblo. Taos Pueblo has been in place for at least 1,000 years. Some say more, but everybody agrees at least 1,000 years. And the traditions around the Taos Blue Lake, or the sacred lake, the Blue Lake, have been in play for the people on the Pueblo that whole time. Somehow, the government, American federal government, ended up owning the area that was the Blue Lake. It's a sacred lake, so if you want to go up and you're not part of the Pueblo, you need to read about it, because otherwise you won't go there. Yeah. So they managed to lobby Richard Nixon, of all people, right in the middle of the Vietnam War, to re-deed the sacred Blue Lake to them. And so now it's back in its rightful ownership and used as it's been used for 1,000 years. And Mabel Dodge Lujan House was owned by Mabel Dodge, but it was deeded to Mabel Dodge by Tony Lujan, her third husband, who was a core member of the Taos Pueblo community. And so the Pueblo land borders Mabel Dodge Lujan House, and it was on the Pueblo land till Mabel Dodge owned it. So there's a barbed wire fence right behind. It's 3 feet from the window, and that is the Pueblo land. So I just wanted to clarify that, because this is something that's really significant here, and people in Taos will look at the Taos Mountain and say the mountain sees them when they come to Taos. And the mountain decides what it's going to do with each person, and then it does it. Is yes. that true? Mystically, it is. Scientifically, can you prove it? Do you need to? No. People believe it. And there's something collectively that goes on around that mountain. So it's more than just a hill rising up from the ground.
And, you know, the reason why I was interested in the mountain, and when I say sacred, when we move into the reality of the case and the reason they wanted the full 48,000 acres back, which the government didn't want to give back to them, it's because it's about water. They wanted the full watershed, which means that they have the lake, which is actually kind of obviously not on Pueblo Peak, it's behind it, because it's one of those glacial lakes, you know, those old lakes that just sits at the top and then feeds the entire water system that is the full watershed. And the reason they wanted to protect the entire watershed is because their religion has a relationship to the preservation of the ecosystem, because the ecosystem is keeping them alive and well and healthy. And so that's the fascination for me. You know, the fascination for me was these religions that I have studied all around the world, because actually the religion in Bali, although it's Hindu, it's actually a very animist form of Hinduism. And so as a land conservationist, as somebody fascinated by water, by somebody who lives with this relationship to the species around me, that's what I was particularly fascinated about. It was about how the sacredness of their land wasn't necessarily, I mean, I don't know the nuance of it, and I haven't gone into the nuance of their religion, because their religion is something that they keep private, and so I haven't gone into that in respect. I've just entered into it as a wonder and a celebration of a relationship of people to land, and the acknowledgement that healthy land means healthy people, which is a motto that I had with my Marine Foundation, because again, I was realizing that maybe people would preserve nature more if they understood the integration, the fact that we have an interdependent relationship with our environment, and that I see people being, especially, you know, wealthy Westerners now being very, you know, interested in their personal health. And so it was like, oh, well, if you actually understood that your personal health was relational to the health of the waters, to the health of the land, then maybe we would start to think about value in a different way, because we just take for granted, don't we, that we have clean air or I mean, we're beginning not to, you know, I'm seeing people now have like a revelation and I'm like, oh my God, is it, you know, like, So that's kind of what I was exploring, if that contextualizes it in any way as well.
That's a fantastic exploration. And we all have water in common.
Yes.
You know, we're how much 80% of our bodies made up of water. Everybody has to drink water every day. If you don't, you will die. So this system of water sharing that moves all around the world is very important. I spend a lot of time in Manila, and water there is equally as important as it is anywhere. The streams through Manila sometimes are quite polluted. You wouldn't want to drink out of them. And so a lot of people have massive water stress. So it's important to remember that the sacred Blue Lake, and maybe the sacredness of it, and I'm speculating here as somebody that's never been there. I'm spiritual enough, I suppose, but the sacredness of it is the fact that we all share water, and that sharing and having enough of it is tied to life itself. And life is sacred to me because I have only one. So if I'm not going to have a sacredness around my life or yours or the rest, what's the point?
Absolutely. I mean, and you touch on this. This is the big thing that I learned during the writing of this book that I didn't know when I first started. And in part, it was to do with the way the Pueblo protects their relationship to that. And, you know, when I worked in Bali, I found there was an openness about their ceremonies that I didn't experience in Taos. And, you know, that was part of my inquiry about kind of understanding, you know, secrecy and sacredness and sovereignty and so many nuances. But, you know, ultimately what I have come to is that belonging is relational. And then we form relationships with everything around us. Everything we do, everywhere we place our attention is the forming of that relationship. And the more we do it, you know, it influences the quality of our lives. And, you know, one of the things I love about water as well is symbolically, it's almost impossible to own. I mean, it's flowing down rivers. I mean, I know we give water rights and stuff like that, but that's actually it's actually quite complex as we see now, because water's flowing, you know, water's going to start at the top and it's going to want to, and if it doesn't flow, it stagnates and becomes toxic. So, you know, I just find it as a metaphor for relationship, the metaphor of the fact that it needs to move, the fact that it's constantly transforming itself. We breathe it in, we breathe it out, it becomes just wonderful. And it's something that, as you say, if we don't value, we're not going to stick around very long. So it's a wonderful metaphor for that.
Well, something else that flows, a bit like water, conversation flows.
Yeah.
And our conversation has moved its way downhill to the top of the hour.
Yes.
And it's time for us to have a little bit of a conclusion, and then we need to say goodbye. So I want to just thank you ever so much for connecting with me and exploring this idea of water at the end, the idea of flow, flowing through all of these cultural things. So before we go, tell folks how they can find out more about your book, how they can connect with you, follow your work, look at the art you make, and we'll say goodbye after that.
Well, the book is Hippie Wars. You can find it at hippiewars.com. There's also hashtag Hippie Wars on Instagram. And it is set within my personal website, which is celiapersephonegregory.com, which also features my marine conservation work as well. So that's the arena within which I'm trying to kind of bind all these ideas, weaving words, weaving wool. We're stronger together.
Okay, Celia, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you very much.
And there you go, my friends. Thus concludes my conversation with Celia Gregory, the author of Hippie Wars. As Celia pointed out in her descriptions of her experiences around the hippie movement, as a European, she had a very different experience than I had as a Southerner trying to be a hippie in North Carolina. If you're wondering about what the European hippie vibe is like these days, if you happen to wind up in Paris, check out the hippie market. It's loaded with vintage clothes from the 60s and the 70s. I thought it was going to be a little boutique. I walked into the place. It was gigantic, packed with stuff. So the fashionable part of being a hippie was at play in Europe during Celia's time and still is. Don't know if it's so much so here in the States or not. Anyway, there's a lot to know about a lot of things. The layers of the hippies. I appreciate all of those new ideas, and I hope you do too. And on that note, it's time to say goodbye. So I will say you've been tuned in to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. The show always airs first on the weekends at WPVM-FM, Asheville, North Carolina, managed by Devine Dial. Thank you. And it also airs on Saturdays, KCEI-FM, Cultural Energy Radio in Taos. Thank you, Robin Collier and Mike Tilley, for managing those stations. If you'd like to reach me, Nave@jamesnave.com. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. I'd like to thank Walter Parks for our theme song, walterparks.com, for more on Walter's music. I love what Walter does, and I'm a big fan of Walter Parks. If you'd like to write and you'd like to join our little writing community, every Saturday we gather on a Zoom call. The door is always open. It's a great community. We work for an hour, generate a piece of writing in 10 minutes, share it, a little bit of an open mic vibe. Happens every Saturday. I've been doing it with my creative collaborator, Allegra Houston, for the last 5 years, a little bit more than 5 years, 274 gatherings. So if you want to be part of the 274 gatherings, you can go to imaginativestorm.com and find out all you need to know about it, or you can email me, nave@jamesnave.com. I would love to hear from you. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. So there it is for now. Thanks ever so much for spending a little time here, and I do appreciate it, and I hope you come back sometime soon. Till then, maybe we'll catch each other on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
Hey Asheville, looking for the perfect place to start your weekend? Tune in to That Record Guy with me, Christopher Rush, every Friday night from 10 till midnight, right here on the only radio station that matters, WPVM 103.7, the voice of Asheville.
Some help. I need a friend. I need some loving, baby. Come on, let me in. Well, I got no baggage and I can't afford. That's why folks keep on catching me and knocking at their doors. And I know it's time for calling out of this hole in the ground. It's been too long running round and round and round and round. I know I'm not the walking on by, says,
come on, man, you were looking bone dry.
So I took a big swig from his bottle, and that was that. I just need somewhere to lay my head and someone there to warm my bed. So, honey, won't you let me in? And I'm sitting right here all by my lonesome, making my home on the paving stone. Cause my honey won't let me in. No, my honey won't let me in. Yeah, my honey won't. need some help. I need a friend. I need some loving, baby. Come on.